It's rather cold outside, isn't it, chaps? Or is it just me here in Munich?
It is cold. How cold is it where
it's
you
freezing.
Are, Mike?
It's about minus 1,000 Kelvin, I think. Yeah, it certainly feels like it. What about over there on that island on which you live?
Yeah, it's cold.
I cycled to work this morning and it was freezing grass monkeys. So cold.
Actually, Mike, I went up to the Lake District at the weekend, went, took a day off and stayed in Wasdale and went walking and there's snow. I had to go walking in the snow. Like it's like 250 metres or something, which is ridiculously low. But it was awesome.
Fantastic. In fact, that might explain why Andrew isn't here at the moment. He must be covered in snow or dead. Because, yeah, it looks like we're going to have to battle on in this podcast without him. But because I am also a northerner, I think I can work as a decent substitute. So, yeah, this is the Linux Voice podcast, season 5, episode... Oh, we need Andrew back. Which episode is it?
No, this is exactly like Andrew.
I have no idea. I think it might be 70.
I don't know. It's awful, isn't it?
Can we switch in future to a date-based model like Ubuntu so we can say this is, you know, November the X's podcast? But in any case, I'm Mike Saunders.
I'm Ben Everard.
And I'm Graham Morrison.
Awesome. Coming up, we have news presented by our news correspondent, Ben Everard. We have finds of the fortnight. We may or may not have some neurons. I'll have to ask myself about that. And we have our super funky, skillotastic voice of the masses. Yeah, if you like that, if you like what we do, working hard on Linux Voice pages, then why not buy a subscription? In fact, just do buy a subscription to Linux Magazine, which is full of awesome geeky stuff, including the big bumper Linux Voice section. And you can subscribe at shop.linuxnewmedia.com. And on that note, I'll hand it over to Ben, who says he's got a big bumper section of really happy news this episode.
It's glorious news this fortnight, Mike. So first up, we have all glory to the supreme leader of the Democratic People's Republic of the United Kingdom, who has vowed to rid the internet of filth created by capitalist running dogs. UK internet is best internet. Her Excellency will personally protect us with a warm, loving embrace that includes looking through our internet browsing history and planting spying devices on our machines. No other world leader has demonstrated such love for their citizens. Instead, they leave them in the unprotected in the cold, uncaring cyberspace. This is, of course, the news that with the passing of the Investigatory Powers Bill 2016 continues its run as the worst year this century.
So this means that like 48 different government agencies, including like, I think, you know, the Woodlands Agency or something, gets access to your entire browsing history,
and
right?
And the food services industry, yeah. The food
services.
Yeah,
well, how else would they know if you're illicitly taking wood from woodland or, I don't know, I don't know what the food service agency does. It's a catastrophically bad bill. It's worded in incredibly loose ways. It has almost no protection, even when it appears to have protection. And it gives access to a huge number of government agencies, none of which have any business being anywhere near any form of private data, let alone incredibly private data, which they can do with this bill. It was rightly scandal when it turned out that GCHQ were doing all sorts of things, spying on charities and that sort of thing. And this just allows it all. I mean, it's just a monumentally bad idea. I mean, the fact that a supposedly democratic nation can go to this level in this day and age is just frankly shocking. I really don't know what else to say about it. It's just appalling.
Well, yeah, this is the usual arguments come up, you know, people saying, well, I've got nothing to hide, but, you know, then why do you have curtains? You know, everybody deserves or has a right to some privacy. And it's also the usual arguments as well. You might think, well, no, I trust the UK government and the, you know, the powers that be in the system we have in place not to abuse this. Well, okay, some may say that's naive, but you know, what about future governments? They could be terrible with all this information. It's a really, really bad thing to put in place.
Yeah, I mean, it gives government huge power over vast numbers of people. It's obviously the record of the government with keeping data safe is far from brilliant, and there's no reason to suspect it's going to get better. The fact that your internet browsing history could be left on a CD on a train in Whitehall, if there were trains in Whitehall, I don't know. but yeah, I mean, it's just awful.
And a sort of tangentially related piece of news, SpaceX, obviously my favorite company in the world, has been applying for permission to put 4,000 satellites into space to launch a worldwide satellite internet service. So you can just connect directly to them as an ISP. It'd be kind of interesting what effect this has on, as countries develop these super invasive spying programs. You know, can we then just get an antenna pointed at SpaceX's stuff? And, you know, assuming Elon is better than Theresa May, our data is a bit more secure.
Yeah, that's the way to go. Go to an American company. I'm pretty sure the Americans aren't spying on anyone.
Yeah, but you see, I don't know if Elon's empire will have to abide by earthly rules because his his internet network is in space. I've no
idea. Think he's going to register his company on Mars.
You see. Oh, well, yeah, that's quite depressing, isn't it?
So is there anything we can do? I mean, I've signed the petition for this to be debated, but we've talked about this a lot over the last couple of years. It seemed unlikely, and now it's crept by when there is no serious opposition in the UK. There's no debate in the House of Parliament. It is truly horrendous, the kind of state that we're leaving for our children, and incredibly depressing. I really try not to be pessimistic. I'm an optimistic kind of person, but really right now I'm just want to leave. Really, I just want to go and live in Canada. This is exactly what it makes me feel.
There's honestly very little we can do. As you say, there's no credible opposition. There's no sort of parliamentary body pushing against this. I don't think at this stage anyone's willing to spend any political capital on creating that. There's other battles to be fought.
No.
And there's a petition that some bod somewhere in Whitehall have to go and look at and say, no, we're not going to debate it in Parliament. It's probably a good idea to sign the petition. I have as well, but I don't expect it to get anywhere.
So I've got I'm sure all of us, I mean, we've got our VPNs turned on at the router, you know, distributing our data to random points across the universe. And that's great for us. But, you know, the 99.99% of the population who aren't going to do that, who can't do that, don't understand what it entails. You know, effectively, if Google was bad, their entire lives now lived out through this microscopic lens of data. I'm absolutely speechless what freedom of speech and democracy has turned into, really.
Yeah, I think the only thing you can really do at this point is use technical measures of protection for as much traffic as possible. If it's the thing that if it becomes normal to use VPNs to bypass this, it becomes normal to use Tor, it's no longer suspicious to do it, and it becomes a more...
Should we fight? Should we try and raise an army? A march on the capital?
It's a long way and it's quite cold.
I kind of feel like left with no other recourse. I'm thinking of violence, Ben.
Linux Voice does not advocate violence.
Well, you know, I've said this on a public, and not, even if I'd not said it on a public forum, it wouldn't make any difference. No.
What can you do?
I'm joking. It's just a joke. Are we allowed to joke? One of my favourite books is by Milan Kundera, and his first novel was called The Joke, and he lived in Czechoslovakia under the Russian occupation, and The Joke is about a boy who is infatuated with a girl, and as a joke he said on a postcard that communism was the opiate of the people. Now, maybe he was a bit foolish putting this on a postcard, but the authorities read it and made his the rest of his life a living misery. You know, it actually reminds me of this kind of situation, or at least what we're putting ourselves into in the future, you know, setting this kind of precedent, not just for us. I mean, okay, so maybe the UK may have the right intentions behind this and maybe we'll be safe with all future governments, but it sets a precedent for all other kinds of democracies and governments to say, well, the UK's done it, you know. Magna Carta to Snooper's Charter. That's what we've got.
Yeah, yeah. Years ago, you know, if you'd read that North Korea monitors absolutely all communications by its citizens, you'd be like, wow, yeah, look at North Korea. What a horrible place that is with all this spying. This is now completely the norm in the United Kingdom. And, you know, people are just like, oh, okay, then. Oh, well, is there any happier news anywhere?
Should we move on to some happier news?
No.
If you just bask in the misery and
I am sorry. Carry on.
Some happier news. Jolla's Sailfish, a mobile Linux operating system, is certified by the Russian government for government and corporate use. I don't know if that's happy or not, but it seems fairly good. If you're Russian in the government and I don't know, want to extort money from people more efficiently on a freer device, you now can. I'm sure Russian officials do more than just extort money from people. I'm not too sure.
It's a joke.
And this is sort of part of their bid to break up the duopoly of Android and iOS, partly because they feel, well, probably mostly because they feel those two companies are slightly too close to the US government. But I think it is one of those things that it's not necessarily done for reasons we'd all agree with, but it's probably benefits a lot of us. And I'd quite like a reasonable third option to Android and iOS.
Did you see, was it a Tor, an Android version, was it Copperhead or something that's going to be running on their own phone? That may provide this. I mean, for us, I guess, if it's backed by the Tor project.
Is that...
It's the hardened
Android. They've been around for a while and have been sort of hardening Android.
Yeah.
I didn't know they were partnering with Tor now, but I knew they'd done similar things for a while.
I seem to remember the news flying by. I could be wrong. But I would pay a lot of money for anything that's kind of backed by the Tor project, especially now.
Yeah. That's... this is the news that Fedora 25 has just been released, and it comes with Wayland, the next generation graphics server that's been around so long it doesn't feel right to call it next generation anymore. But it's been that bit of software that they've been saying, oh, it'll be in the next release for probably five releases now. But it's finally here, and it should significantly improve video performance on Linux. When I say video, I don't mean sort of watching movies. I mean general graphic display type things. So screen tearing and that sort of thing should be a thing of the past.
That's great news. Yeah, I mean, as Fedora has been shipping Wayland, I think, previous releases, but this is the first time they've turned it on by default, isn't it? If you put it fresh on a hard drive,
yeah,
booted
it's been
up,
around in quite a few places before.
Yeah.
This is the first time it's really been there for the regular users.
I mean, that is major development in a way, isn't it? Completely changing the underlying graphical layer of our GNU/Linux systems. Yeah, I mean, I think it's great. X has obviously served pretty well over the years, but had its problems. You know, we've tried Wayland in Rebecca Black OS, at least that's the only real exposure I've had to it. But yeah, good on them.
Yeah, it is. It's fantastic that it's here, but it's one of those things that I can't get excited about it because I got excited about it when they said they were going to release it 5 years ago, and now the moment's passed for me, but it is good news.
I wonder if this will spur on Canonical and Ubuntu to start shipping Mir by default, so we can have some nice next generation or current generation display subsystem wars.
Yeah, and actually see what they're like, you know, when they're actually instable, not just bits that you can install or activate if you particularly want to. Although perhaps we'll just end up with a system next year where software only works on either Ubuntu or Fedora and not both.
Let's hope not. I mean, I guess when, you know, it's all down to the toolkits, isn't it? If GTK and Qt work on both, then that covers 99% of desktop Linux apps, I assume. Apart from Xbill.
Apart from what?
Xbill. You remember Xbill?
Oh, is that the Bill Gates thing?
Yeah, the little game where it was like the only game included on Linux distros back in the 1990s. Little Bill Gateses were running around on your desktop trying to put Windows on every computer they could see, and you had to click them to destroy them or something. I just remember it didn't use GTK or Qt. I'm a treasure chest of useless knowledge.
But will it work on Wayland?
Well, that's it. If it doesn't, then, you know, that's the end. What kind of operating system doesn't play Xbill?
I suppose, yeah, it can't really work on Wayland if it's called Xbill. We need Waylandbill.
All right.
Which sounds like an obscure nautical place.
Set up a GitHub repo.
Watch out, many a ship's been moored, gone to ground on Waylandbill.
All right.
Awesome. Right, should we move on to our final piece of news this fortnight?
Yes.
And that is that 64-bit Linux has come to the Raspberry Pi via SUSE. This is Raspberry Pi's had been 64-bit since version 3, which is, my memory can't go back so far, but it's been quite a while since it's been out. But all the OSs have stuck with 32-bit, partly to work on the old ones and partly because there are so few 64-bit ARM Linux platforms out there. I don't think there was that much excitement in creating distributions for them. But SUSE stepped up, did all the sort of boring poking around in hardware, compiling stuff with weird options and hitting it with a hammer until it begrudgingly decides to work. And they've done it. They are, I believe, in the process of upstreaming their changes. So it should, fingers crossed, flow through to more 64-bit distros working on the Pi.
So what are the benefits of running a 64-bit distro on the Pi? I thought, you know, usually it's been access to much more RAM, but I guess that's not a big deal on the Pi.
No, I mean, to be honest, they're not that huge. It really comes down to if you happen to be crunching 64-bit numbers, which some people probably do. I've never benchmarked 64-bit against 32-bit on ARM, so I'm not completely sure. As you say, RAM has always been the biggest one, but since PAE, that hasn't even been that big a deal.
Hmm. Longevity as well, I guess. I mean, with distributions dropping 32-bit support, you know, it means that the Raspberry Pi, old Raspberry Pis, even will stay relevant.
Yeah. To be honest, the reason I always feel like I should run 64-bit versions, so I just feel sad for the half the registers that just sit there empty, never used. Someone's gone to a huge amount of trouble to etch these tiny little scratches on bits of carefully sliced sand.
Someone.
State-of-the-art technology. Yeah, so imagine sitting there with a knife and carving out a few nanometers. Lithography is a Raspberry Pi in like 22 nanometer or something, probably bigger than that. But someone sat there and sliced out, you know, little channels just a few nanometers wide, and you're just going to leave them get idle to rot.
You got a bit
or whatever.
It's crazy how cheap the Raspberry Pi is when you think that it's entirely made by hand, including the CPU. Yeah.
I'll be honest, I don't fully understand how CPUs are made.
You don't have to. You just use them. The magic. I did see a Reddit discussion about this just earlier today, and somebody was saying that he tried it but went back to a 32-bit OS because Firefox on 64-bit SUSE on his Pi was just munching up much, much more memory. So maybe that's the problem with these giant handmade registers, that actually the small cutesy weenie registers are better on your RAM banks.
It is true that memory pointers in 64-bit obviously take up twice the space as 32-bit. At least I think they would. I don't know enough about CPU internals to be sure about that, but it sounds like they probably would. I don't know. I mean, can Firefox take up any more memory? I wasn't aware that was possible.
Ah, oh, yes, that's true.
That brings us to the end of the news.
Good work, Ben. It wasn't as depressing as suspected it might be.
I'm fairly depressed still.
Yes.
I'm sure Graham can cheer us up with some fine.
Do I look like I'm going to cheer you up?
Your lighting always makes you look particularly cheerful. For some reason, there's just a slightly blue glow over you.
Well, my webcam, I think maybe my webcam's got a blue light that says when it's on. Well, at least when it's on and I know that it's on, you know, not when it's on and the UK government knows it's on. So maybe that's what it is. So it's now time for finds of the fortnight. I asked the IRC channel before we started, just before we started, as is tradition, and wonderful group of people in there. Zed Moylan Pie, I love the way that he must run a bouncer on his pie. You can now use a Commodore 64 to chat on Slack.
I saw this on Hacker News, actually.
Yeah, so that's pretty cool. I'd love to... How do they sort the networking out? Is this, I have seen like TCP/IP running on a Commodore 64 before, but I've really, as much as I love this retro stuff, I don't know if I could go all that way.
Do you have to sort of record it onto a cassette, then run over, put the cassette into another machine, and it uploads it?
I know. I think it was Andrew Conway accused us of being a meager voice last episode, so I'm going to try not to get too nostalgic about the wonderful Commodore 64 and its lack of networking. Although I once had a wonderful time playing Stunt Car Racer with an RS-232 serial connection with a friend. Good times.
I learned to program on a Commodore 64. Don't knock them; they're great
they
machines.
Are, yeah. I mean, they've got a built-in like assembler. It's awesome.
Yeah.
ZX Spectrum forever. Z80 way better than 6502.
Let's not go. But it had so much RAM and the SID chip. You know, I do get emails in private because people don't want to like say it in public that they like it when I go on about audio stuff.
Are you sure? It's not just like your mum or somebody.
No, well, my mum grew up with me making all of these noises out of Commodore 64, so she, you know, she's, I'm sure she's happy to see the back of me.
Yeah. Are they from 4chan?
I don't know what 4chan is. Ms. May.
It's a hacker.
Yeah. So Zed Moylan then goes on to say, there's this whole spying charter in the UK that makes China and Saudi Arabia look enlightened. McPhail says, I've been enjoying playing Tetris instead. They provide a link to Sedtris on GitHub. I must try that. I'm sure I've mentioned I used to work in a video shop and it ran DOS on the little database system that we used to log the videos. And I got really good at the original Tetris on DOS because I could switch between it and the check-in system. So Tetris in ANSI characters is the way to play Tetris. So lots of geek points awarded to Zed Moylan for that find. I mean, sorry, McPhail for that find. And Dr. Hitchcock, who seems very happy to have happened to catch our IRC request at the time, the pre-orders of the R Duo Boy, have you seen this? Has been delivered a couple of weeks ago. Such a fun Wii device. It's even got Breakout. I think I saw this on the news stories this week. It's like millimeters thick with a black and white screen. It's based on Arduino and it plays games. So it looks like a Game Boy, but it's much thinner and it's running DIY stuff.
What does Breakout actually mean? Does it just mean it's got GPIO pins?
I think Breakout means Pong, you know?
A breakout. I'm thinking a breakout board or something.
I think it's like a game. It's like it's a handheld. It's meant. It's got this form factor for games. I guess you could do anything you want with it.
But yeah, generally on sort of hackable hardware, breakout means a way of connecting stuff to it.
Oh, I'm so glad you said that, Ben. I thought I was really like just handing my geek card then.
Or maybe it's a capital B and.
So often you get sort of surface mounted connectors and you'll get a breakout board, which is that sort of soldered on when you can't solder it by hand or not easily.
Oh, and,
it allows you to connect wires to it.
That's a relief.
So I was also emailed a find. This is from Hanareto. And the find is Poodle. Oh, this is actually... This is interesting because I don't want to try and pronounce their name again, but they're in the Bodhinyana Monastery, which is cool. I think that's cool. Poodle is a GPL V3 web-based application for the translation of text into any number of languages. It supports the GNU GetText API and PO file format and is used to internationalize software applications. And they say that... Ajahn Sejutu, a Buddhist monk, I guess at the monastery, is using the software to provide translations of the ancient Pali scripts, which is the equivalent to a shelf full of texts that will take several years to complete, and they'll be available on their website.
So, do they mean that's machine translation, or it's just sort of a tool to help you manage translations?
I think it's machine translation. I've not checked. But by the way it's worded, I don't know whether they're transcribing it manually or using OCR. But I have to have a look.
Yeah, the LibreOffice guys use Poodle for their translation.
Oh, okay.
As well.
So what's the source of the translation data?
I think they just take the English version and then people then there are different branches for different versions of the software, and then people just go in and update them. So, you know, a German will go in, look at the latest English text and update it to German. I don't know that much, but I don't know if there's any automatic translation that goes on.
Right. Oh, I see. Okay.
But it's obviously pretty capable if it can handle something as huge as LibreOffice.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So they're the finds from outside the window. Thank you. Anybody want to share their finds? I've got a couple. Shall I go?
Yeah.
My first one is like, I suppose, linked to, if this goes out on Thursday, it's the beginning of Nativity. So I've got a semi-religious Christian find. And that's that. There's some... controversy over whether Jesus actually turned water into wine or water into...
So it's some controversy.
Yes. I'm being diplomatic here. I don't want to offend anyone. But I find it interesting having, you know, watched Life of Brian, that he may not have turned water into wine and may indeed have turned it into beer instead, because it depends on the word, the way that the word is translated. And so in the journal... Biblical Archaeological Review, Michael Hammond argues that many biblical scholars have misinterpreted early texts, translating to wine when the more sensible translation is beer. I think it's to do with class, the class that of people that are using the word. So, I like the idea that Jesus actually made water into beer. And I don't want to talk about realism, but that's much more realistic.
I suppose, but no, how is that more realistic?
Well, because you can just make water into beer, can't you? With wine, you have to get, you turn grapes into wine.
Well, yeah, I suppose, yeah, with beer, you soak your malt or boil your malt in your water and hops and yeast.
Well, yeah, but you start off with, you have a lot of water to start off with and you end up with a lot of water only imbibed by... Anyway, maybe I shouldn't have brought this up.
I've always found the sort of classifications of different alcoholic drinks fairly arbitrary, to be honest. It's wine if it's grapes, it's cider if it's apples, it's beer if it's malt. But then there's anything else doesn't really have a word.
Yeah. I guess it's tradition.
Yeah.
I'm trying.
Arbitrarily called sake rice wine, but why is that wine? It's not very wine-like. No grapes in it.
Yeah, yeah. You're right. Have you tried your cider yet?
Oh. Hello.
Wow.
Right. Hey, it's time for the podcast. What have I missed? Where are we up to?
It's finds. Finds of the fortnight. So you've not missed much, apart from a rant about the Snoopers Charter.
Okay.
My second find is actually courtesy of somebody on Twitter, which I really should thank them for. I'm trying to sign into Twitter to thank them for. But it's actually, you may have seen this already, it's a cool retro term.
Yeah.
This was in response to my lecture, I think it was their words, on shaders in MAME last episode, saying that I would like cool retro term. And indeed, I do like cool retro term because it seems to implement all of the shaders I was talking about into a terminal emulator, a console terminal emulator. So it's amazing.
In that terminal window, you could then have a DOS emulator and play ASCII Tetris.
Yeah. You're right. I should try it because it has loads of different probes. So in this terminal, it creates an amber display. It has all of the things that we were talking about in the last episode, scan lines. It has noise. It has all kinds of distortion to make the terminal look exactly like it would have done in 1982 or whatever.
It's got all the things that audiovisual engineers have worked for the past 30 years to get rid of.
Yeah, and screen manufacturers. It's so funny, you know, flat screens and where you can't see the pixels is what, you know, humankind has been trying to do for so long. But now we've got there, we now have to turn it back to the curved displays showing, you know, curved CRT emulations. But one of the nice things about it is that it's really well implemented. The shaders work brilliantly. And it uses fonts and various effects to recreate lots of different text-based interfaces. So one of them is one of those very early DOS machines with the font and everything. It looks really authentic. I should definitely try and find Tetris, the old Tetris executable, and run it in DOSBox. So that's my main point. I've installed it and built it. It uses console, so it fits into a KDE desktop really well. I don't use it for, like, productivity reasons, but it's awesome. It's great to run top in it and just leave it on the corner of the display. They're my finds.
Does it make you look lead?
Yeah, I think it does, yeah. I think if you're a film director, you'd use it. Do the sequel to War Games.
Shall I go now?
Yeah, yeah.
I've got a few finds this fortnight. The first two are pretty minor, but they came in handy, so I thought I'd mention them. The first one is, if you've ever used DMessage, which prints out the kernel buff and provides all sorts of useful debugging tools, it's fantastic, but the time is in this weird sort of, well, it's just a number, I don't know what it is, but I think it's milliseconds since the computer turned on or something like that. It's not helpful at all. I only just discovered if you pass it -T, it gives you the actual time. Why that's not the default, I have absolutely no idea. Who thought, I know what people want to see in their logs. Yeah. Milliseconds since they turned on the computer.
That's like the -H on so many commands, you know, that gives you a human readable size for things. You know, you think, what is it if it's not going to be a human at the end of it?
The second one is, I don't know if you've ever been in this situation where you're typing a command, you're like, oh yeah, and then I need to pipe it into that, and then sort of, yeah, maybe X args there. And you sort of think, hang on, I've got like 3 lines worth of text here, and I can't really work out what's going on. It'd be really helpful if I had a text editor so I could sort of pop back and pop forwards and sort of edit it properly. If you're on the command line, type Control X, Control E, and it will pop the command you're currently in into your text editor. So you can edit it. Yeah, sort of move around and copy and paste and all the sort of things you do usually in your text editor. And I'll just use a default text editor that you set up in your environment. So Vi or Nano or whatever you've got. That's quite handy if you're up your armpits in a horrible command. My slightly larger find is Cyber Chef. And this is a tool that's created by GCHQ, the government's lovely, fun protection wing that has all our best interests at heart and just wants to keep nasty people off the internet. They've created this tool that just helps you sort of, does all sort of things you need to do with network analysis, translate between different character formats and that sort of thing that, to be honest, the sort of stuff you need to do if you're hacking into stuff. That's what it does. They call it a Swiss Army knife of network tools.
Things that they've needed over the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, yeah. Basically, if you're, if you're in the middle of someone's smartphone and they've got a weird character encoding and you don't know how to spy on their communications, open up Side of a Chef. It's a web-based tool. You can run it through GitHub, and it probably doesn't send all your data back to GCHQ.
Doesn't matter now.
Yeah, it doesn't matter now. It's quite handy for that sort of general chunking data around into different formats and analyzing it in different ways. Also, just before coming on air, asked Twitter if they had any finds they'd like me to mention. And some reprobate called Andrew Gregory has said to add that his find is that the internet is down.
It's back up now, so that find is now obsolete.
Obsolete finds. Those are my finds this fortnight.
Sweet, sweet finds, Ben.
Thanks, Ben. I don't know if Mike's still around or whether, he's become amorous with whoever's lying on the sofa behind him.
I am still here, don't worry. There's nobody on my sofa, but I just have terrible internet. So, I've had a find emailed to me, but I'm going to mix it up and convert it into a neuron. There's just no knowing where this podcast is going to go. But the other find that I have is somebody on Reddit posted a pretty cool image, I think today or yesterday, and it compares DistroWatch's top rankings in 2006 with 2016. So I think you can just bring up this data yourself, but I won't go through all the different distros, but it's just quite interesting that back in 2006, the top three distros were Ubuntu, OpenSUSE, and Fedora. And those are still in the top 10 today. But number four was Mepis.
Wow.
Anybody remember Mepis?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I remember Mepis.
Yeah, Mepis and Simply Mepis from Warren Woodford.
That's like, right.
I never knew anybody actually who used Mepis. But Mepis whenever I went...
Yep. It was one of the really early live distros, wasn't it?
Was it?
When most distros wouldn't,
that,
yeah.
That and Gnopis.
Because for about 9 months, I didn't have a hard drive for... Basically, it broke and it took me ages to fix it. So I could only use live distros. And there's Demo Linux, there's Nopix, and there was Mepis. And Mepis was better than the other two. Wow, so better. I think it was just released more recently when I had my issues. It had later software.
Wow, so now I do know somebody who used Mepis at some point. It's interesting that, Mepis was at number four in 2006, and it's not even in the top 100 distros today, and there's a lot of really obscure distros listed on DistroWatch today, so Mepis has effectively completely disappeared.
Yeah.
And it's kind of similarly, but not so extreme. Number 10 back in 2006 was Gentoo, and that's fallen way back to number 35 now. Of course... And funnily enough, number 10 now is Arch. So I think Arch has pretty much replaced Gentoo. So many Gentoo users I knew have just moved on to Arch. A very similar sort of distro, but I don't know, with a better wiki, I guess. So that's my find.
Brilliant. So I don't know if you've had a chance to find anything, Andrew, if your internet's been down.
Well, yeah. Now that the internet's back, it only went down like half an hour, 1 hour before we were due to start recording the podcast. So I've been turning things off and turning them back on again for the last 90 minutes, and now everything's working. But before that, I discovered or found, I can never remember. We were talking about OpenStreetMap last podcast and how it's... because it's all cool and open and has lots of detail that Google Maps and Bing Maps don't have. It's just far more useful if you want to do something with it, if you want to overlay your own layers or add your own bits of information to it. or indeed share it. And so that's what I've found this fortnight. It's a project done by the London School of Economics and can be found at booth.lse.ac.uk. And they've gone through the archives of a chap called Charles Booth, who I'd never heard of, but was a mega rich philanthropist, sort of the Iron Man of his day. And he's got he mapped poverty in London and then correlated it against crime. But the really cool thing is that the LSE's got this map now. And it's based on OpenStreetMap data, and you can slide between the map from 1860-odd or 1870-odd and then change the transparency of it so that you can see modern London underneath. And you can just... And it works really, really easily and seamlessly, and you can only do it because the data is open. So
that's very cool.
It is... We talk about open data as if, and it's often quite abstract, you know. We talk about, you know, people's right to use and share and distribute, but actually, when you see something tangible like that, it does make you realise that it's just so damn cool, really, really cool.
That's really good. I want to try it now.
Yeah, you can move around. It's just exactly as if it were, you know, OpenStreetMap, but yeah, like with the same interface, they're zooming in, zooming out, and you can see where the baddies used to live. Not the baddies, the poor people. Sorry, easy to get mixed up.
Yes, Donald.
Your membership of the Conservative Party is confirmed.
Right. That's it, isn't it? That's it for finds.
Yeah.
Those
are finds.
There was one more I forgot to read out. I can just sit at the top of the IRC. Dr. Hitchcock again says, because they're so pleased about getting into the IRC channel. And I saw this come up on, I think it was Reddit Linux, www.riot.im, an open alternative to Slack, which bridges IRC. Based on Matrix and can do end-to-end encryption. Looks like a really cool messaging front-end, and I meant to try it, but I haven't tried it yet.
But does it run on the Commodore 64?
I don't know. that must be to come with an RS-232 cable.
And after that brief technical interlude, we now know that Mike's mic is working fine, which is just as well, because after the halfway reminder, which is now, still to come, we've got Speak, Vocalize Your Neurons, and the voice of the masses, it's now time for Vocalize Your Neurons, coming from Mike. So, Mike's mic, over to you, Mike.
Ciao.
Ciao, Mike.
My mic seems to be in order. So, yeah, converting that find from earlier into a neuron. This is from David Baxter, who says, I recently had to abort a presentation because my laptop wouldn't display on the HDMI monitor. It detected the monitor type and resolution correctly, but there was no output on the screen. Later, I used another cable with no problems. It was then I discovered that some HDMI cables are polarized. Careful examination of such a cable shows that the plug at the TV/monitor end has a monitor pictogram, while the plug at the device end is blank. I've got to admit, I didn't know that. Did you guys know that?
I've never come across that.
No. I didn't know that.
No,
I mean, maybe if you buy super fancy triple gold-plated cables or something, they have these, but yeah.
Audiophile HDMI cables.
Yeah. But yeah, well, that's always something to, it's one of those things you wouldn't necessarily look at if you were having problems connecting your machine to a monitor. And now we know you should look at it just in case. So thanks for that find/neuron, David.
Who makes a cable that's exactly the same at both ends, but actually matters which way round you plug it in? Which genius thought that idea?
That's what it sounds like.
And then having done that, why only mark it at one end?
Yeah.
Yeah, don't ask me. This has nothing to do with me.
We've lost control.
I'm just the messenger.
Take back control.
So, anyhow, if anybody wants their find/neuron read out on this lovely podcast, then email me, mike@linuxvoice.com.
Great, so we've had the news, we've had the halfway reminder, we've had the finds, we've had the neuron, which must mean only one thing. It's now time for the voice of the masses.
While Andrew tries to find his tab, I can go back to one find that I forgot to mention. And this is that you may have heard in the news, it might not have even been this fortnight, but there was a mess up in the NHS email and someone sent an email to everyone who worked for the NHS and loads of people replied to it saying, take me off this mailing list, why is everything coming to it? And sort of several thousand emails ended up getting sent to everyone. And my wife happens to work for the NHS and got all this emails. That's not my find. My find is that a shocking proportion of people who work for the NHS have Comic Sans as their default email font. So seriously, some of them were like serious medical people and the email came out in like pink Comic Sans. Anytime you think about writing something in Comic Sans, stop and take a long, hard look at what you're doing before going any further.
Next time you're lying on that in that operating theatre, you're going to ask the surgeon before, what font do you use before you cut my body up?
Yeah. I mean, if you happen to be creating a comic book, Comic Sans is fine. If you're telling something about a serious medical condition, Comic Sans is not fine.
Yeah.
That should be a flowchart.
Yeah.
I think the only way around that is to privatise Comic Sans and the NHS. And now it's time for the voice of the masses. Should Microsoft be allowed to join the Linux Foundation? It might sound like a flock of pigs are flying through an especially cold day in hell, but it's true. Microsoft has joined the Linux Foundation and is a platinum member. Wow. Given Microsoft's uneasy relationship with GNU/Linux and free software in the past, and ongoing patent issues, it makes us wonder, should the company even be allowed to join the Linux Foundation? Let us know your opinions. Do you think Microsoft has changed sufficiently to become a trustworthy member of the Foundation? That, if I may interject there, actually, that is predicated on membership of the Foundation being related some way to trustworthiness.
I was going to say, isn't the Foundation just what you join when you want to use the Linux kernel without releasing your source code changes?
Indeed.
Or have I misunderstood its purpose?
It must have a purpose. There's a purpose there somewhere, isn't there? Surely. Anyway, Ray Woods, where are you, Ray? I believe Microsoft are only doing it for Microsoft's benefit. They must have their systems working well with networks, which means working with Linux. As to whether Microsoft has changed will depend on how they coexist with Linux. Will they stop the way other manufacturers coexist with Linux? We will know when I can at last update my TomTom or Garmin sat-navs on Linux. Yeah, but should they be allowed? Should they be allowed to join the Linux Foundation? That was the question. Has anyone answered that? Tom Watson says, why not? We know that Microsoft has worked against the free software community in the past, but surely this shows that they no longer wish to destroy us and instead respect Linux and FOSS as parts of the ecosystem. Microsoft respects Linux and FOSS. Discuss, Ben.
Microsoft is a company. Microsoft does what benefits Microsoft, otherwise they wouldn't be a massively successful company. And they, you know, it's no secret they do a lot with Linux these days. You know, a huge chunk of there is your cloud is running Linux, and they've donated a lot of code to the kernel, mostly to make it run better on the Azure cloud. Should they be allowed to join the Linux Foundation? I mean, I don't see why not. There's plenty of companies there that have done pretty nasty things to free software and are still allowed to give money to help the Linux kernel do what the Linux Foundation do what the Linux Foundation does. Though similarly, I'm not entirely sure what that is.
Someone has answered that question about what the Linux Foundation does. Duncan says, the purpose of the creation of the Foundation was to allow Linus to continue his work without dealing with the influence of money. So even though I still do not trust Microsoft, I think this is a good thing. Microsoft are only involved because they recognize the importance of Linux in the cloud. And Linux is now important for them to make money. And Steve Weaver says, join, yes. However, what would concern me is the level of influence they have within it, within the Linux Foundation. Not knowing the conditions of membership for the Linux Foundation, I would balk if they had somehow bought a specific control or additional weight to their opinion, just by virtue of who they are. However, I have faith that the other members of the Linux Foundation will hold the line. Hold the line, just like Maximus Decimus Meridius. Shadow Firebird says, sure, why not? It's not us that allows. After all, we can't stop them. A better question would be, does that devalue the foundation? To which the answer is, probably. But thanks to you folks, that's us, I know that its value is questionable anyway.
This hasn't done anything to change my mind.
Graham, you have questioned the value of the Linux Foundation.
Yes.
Does this fit, do you think, with their MA?
I'm actually going to defer to the rather wonderful Simon Phipps, who made a very factual as he could be based on the fact that Microsoft very rarely publishes its figures, blog post and series of tweets. Really, the core of it was that he said that the $500,000 that Microsoft has paid to join the Linux Foundation is about 0.25% of its revenue from patent threats against Linux. Income from patent threats against Linux is about the same as Red Hat's entire turnover. So, and I think he's spot on with this. He's not really making a judgment other than stating as much of the facts as he can. He says, the Linux Foundation should include its membership in its membership agreement a good faith commitment to not initiate any patent litigation relating to the Linux platform, and Microsoft should declare that no part of the company will in future initiate software patent claims against the Linux platform, and as a sign of good faith, join the Open Invention Network, or the OSI. And I completely agree with him, and I don't think... It doesn't surprise me, but I don't think the Linux Foundation should have accepted Microsoft's membership unless it had gone some way to reassure other Linux vendors and Linux contributors that they would do something to curb Microsoft's patent claims against Linux.
And listeners, if you like the sound of what Simon Phipps has just said there, you can read more of his words in the Linux Voice section of Linux Magazine, which is on sale at all good news agents now. Colin Parker says, it's easy to be suspicious of the motives of large institutions, but it is actually the behaviour of the people within them that actually counts. Microsoft's change of posture, while being driven by practical necessity, is still an indication of a change of attitude at the top. Possibly. Open source values will drive up the quality of their output. Possibly. And their engineering contribution to open source projects, however motivated, should be welcomed. And Rakios says, that depends, in reply to that, Rakios says, that depends on what the change in attitude has been. If it's simply a case of, oh well, FUD and litigation haven't worked, so let's go back to embrace, extend, extinguish, then I don't really see that as a good thing. Mike, are you there?
Hello.
You remember the bad old days of FUD, don't you? The fear, uncertainty and doubt that Microsoft used as a marketing campaign against Linux. Do you think that they've changed, you know? Do you believe them, that they love us now?
Probably not. I mean, it's obviously a very different corporate mentality inside Microsoft after Steve Ballmer went. You know, it seemed his objective was simply to destroy all competition, regardless of whoever else loses. Whereas Nadella and some of the other guys seem to be more pragmatical, like, well, Linux is there. It's going to be there to stay in the cloud and on servers. So maybe we should get on with it. But I think Simon Phipps just put it in the best words possible. Yeah. You know, if they really want to show they're committed to Linux, or at least, you know, competing healthily with Linux and interoperating with it, then stop extorting all this money out of people with patents. Otherwise, it doesn't make much sense for them to be a part of the Linux Foundation.
I wonder how many... I mean, obviously, on the face of it, the answer is, of course, that the Linux Foundation should let anybody join if they want to stump up the cash to help them do their work, whatever that work may be. But I wonder how many other companies were mulling over joining the Linux Foundation and have seen this news and have decided, oh, actually, no, that's not the sort of company that we want to keep.
Hmm.
Now, how many of the existing members were thinking about upgrading to a titanium or diamond polymimetic alloy membership and they've decided not to bother now?
I don't think Red Hat's even a platinum member. You know, I don't think Red Hat can afford to be a platinum member, which is the tier that Microsoft's gone in at.
Given the history, it does sully the Linux Foundation's moral authority. But then I guess they've never claimed to be the moral authority, have they?
No.
That's always lain with the FSF.
You know, and as I think Ben's mentioned in the past, they have, as a trade organisation, they have a legal obligation to promote the needs of their members. You know, and for that reason, they're promoting themselves, and you know, $500,000 will go a long way.
So, blimey, that seems quite downbeat.
Yes, yeah. Let's cheer it up. Nobody should be allowed to burn the American flag. If they do, there must be consequences, perhaps loss of citizenship or a year in jail.
Yeah, that's a good one. Oh, dear. Yeah.
What about people who burn penguin flags?
Yes, they should be banished from the Linux Foundation.
What about the Confederate flag?
I thought it was illegal to fly the Confederate flag in the US.
Right? No, I mean to burn it. Be quite a cheeky test case. You know what the different lengths of sentence you'd get for burning one and burning the other.
What if you just lightly singe it?
Yeah.
Surely the ultimate insult would be to like spill your tea on it or something.
Yeah. Or soil your US flag underwear. You know. You tell anyone.
Well, that's certainly lightened the mood there. Yeah. Well done, everybody. Continue on with the Article 50 negotiations, and we'll probably see you in 2 weeks.
Excellent. Thank you.
Is there a winner?
I'm so glad I managed to get the internet working again. It wouldn't
be the same without you, Andrew.
Is there a winner in the open ballot, or voice of the masses, even? So, yes, no question for once.
I think the winner, or rather the consensus is, yes, but keep an eye on them because they're dodgy. We only have circumstantial evidence to suggest that they are the killers. We're waiting for the cold, hard forensics. Until then, all we can do is observe patiently.
Ronald Reagan, trust, then verify.
Yes. Right then, what's Hillary Clinton's lead in the popular votes standing at the moment?
Depends whether or not you include the millions of illegals that voted.
Hey, we can't. I mean, we can laugh, obviously, but we can't laugh too loud. Well, how many votes did the SNP need to get for their 50 odd MPs? And how many votes did it take UKIP to get their one MP? I think our system is far from perfect. So it really is time to go now. I've not had my dinner.
No, I've not had mine.
Pork chop is not. It's not going to eat itself. So I bid you all adieu. Until next time, au revoir.
Good night.
Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.